From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a gilded hall in the Kremlin today, the mood was pretty much ecstatic. Applause and shouts of joy as President Vladimir Putin spoke, televised to the Russian people, saying that Crimea, quote, was and is an inseparable part of Russia. When his speech was done, he signed a treaty to annex Crimea. And now, what? This hour on Point, Russia and the West, and what comes next? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How are you reading this? No big deal? Not worth going to the mat over a little Black Sea peninsula? Or really bad news with maybe more to come? What is happening here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Big crowd at the Kremlin today for President Putin's speech, and Russians watching across the country as he said, you know, people there applauding and shouting, some weeping. Putin strode out of the hall after his speech and prepared to sign an annexation treaty. Here's Vladimir Putin today.
Today, based on the results of the referendum that took place in Crimea, based on the free will of the people, I'd like to submit to the Federal Assembly the constitutional law on accepting two new constituent parts of Russia, the Republic of Crimea and the city of Sevastopol.
Happy to do it. They voted. Our troops are down there. Let's bring them on in. This after President Obama had said sanctions will be imposed on Russia, are being imposed, and maybe more to come for exactly this.
We'll continue to make clear to Russia that further provocations will achieve nothing except to further isolate Russia and diminish its place in the world. The international community will continue to stand together to oppose any violations of Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity. And continued Russian military intervention in Ukraine will only deepen Russia's diplomatic isolation and exact a greater toll on the Russian economy.
We will go in just a moment to U.S. Ambassador who just left the post a couple of months ago, Michael McFaul. But first, let's go to Crimea and the capital of Simferopol, where Guy Chazan joins us, correspondent for the Financial Times. Guy, are they watching in Crimea as President Putin speaks in Moscow?
Yes, I was just in the center of Simferopol a short while ago, and near the Crimean Parliament, a group of self-defense activists were watching the speech on someone's laptop, and they were in a jubilant mood, very happy that this has finally happened. A lady came up to me and she said that she had a dream on Sunday morning, the day of the referendum, that Crimea would be part of Russia, and her dream has come true now. She was absolutely ecstatic. The self-defense guys said that they're going home. Crimea is going home to its historic motherland. There's generally a lot of happiness here in the streets of Simferopol, that has to be said, and particularly in Sevastopol, which is an even more fervently pro-Russian city. That's the base of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, of course.
Is there a sense, Guy, that this is it, Crimea, and that's all? Or is there active conversation there where you are in Crimea that this may not be over, that another chunk of eastern Ukraine may ultimately be taken into the Russian fold?
Well, I don't think really the Crimeans think that way. They don't really care. I mean, they just sort of, they've always seen themselves as very much apart from Ukraine and even eastern Ukraine. They see themselves as having a very special status. You know, they were given by Nikita Khrushchev to Ukraine in 1954 in a rather high-handed way, and they feel very resentful of that. They feel that this referendum and the treaty that was signed today is righting a historical wrong. So they don't really care that much about eastern Ukraine. Obviously, in Moscow, I'm sure there's plenty of people who are hoping that this is the beginning of a much broader kind of movement, that maybe Russia is now going to gather in the lands that were ceded to other countries after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which contained large Russian-speaking populations. That's definitely the way they're thinking. I think Moscow seems to be swept up in a very, very strong patriotic mood at the moment, and a very sort of irredentist mood. I mean, they really do want to get back a lot of the territories that that they lost, that they consider sort of historically Russian territories that were lost after the Soviet Union collapsed.
Guy, is there any conversation there where you are in Crimea of the rejection of all this by the West, Europe and its sanctions, Washington and its sanctions? Is that on people's minds?
No, they don't care. I mean, you know, the thing is that this is a very sort of cut off. It's a very isolated place, Crimea. There's a lot of pensioners here. It's not very sort of integrated into the global economy. Let's put it that way. It's actually very sort of provincial and kind of parochial. A lot of people have very parochial concerns. They're just worried about their pensions. They hope that maybe joining Russia means that they'll get bigger pensions and bigger welfare payments generally. They don't really care about what the West will throw at them. I mean, it was kind of comical in a way that, you know, a lot of the sanctions were, that which were announced in the last couple of days, were aimed at local politicians, you know, Crimean politicians who engineered this referendum and this annexation. And really, I mean, these are very, very small scale sort of, you know, neighborhood people. I mean, you know, they're obviously, you know, they've been colluding with Russia on this whole matter for a long time now. But it does seem rather ridiculous that they're being targeted by international, you know, sanctions. I'd be very surprised if any of them have foreign bank accounts.
The EU and Washington going after the ward bosses, it sounds like. Of course, it's got a bigger international
profile. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's very small scale. It's. I mean, obviously, you know, they're talking about ratcheting it up, and this is just the first move. But it is rather comical that they're going after people who are just on such a sort of basic parochial level of politics.
Guy Chazan with the Financial Times in Simferopol, the capital of Crimea. Guy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We go in just a moment to the former U.S. ambassador to Russia. Here's the Russian President Vladimir Putin again during his Kremlin speech today. Here he is in that speech blaming the West for creating the Ukraine crisis by being short-sighted, crossing a red line.
In the case of Ukraine, our Western partners have crossed a line, a red line. They've been unprofessional. They've been irresponsible. They knew perfectly well that there are millions of Russians in Crimea and Ukraine. So why did they lose long-sighted approach? They didn't think of the consequences. If you press the spring too hard, it will recoil.
If you press the spring too hard, it will recoil. Vladimir Putin there today in Moscow. With us right now from Stanford, California, Ambassador Michael McFaul. Until last month, he was U.S. Ambassador to Moscow, now a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. Michael McFaul, Ambassador McFaul, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Vladimir Putin saying there, if you press the spring too hard, it will recoil. Did the West, did the United States press too hard on Russia's southern flank?
No. That's not my view at all. The United States, back when I was part of the Obama administration, together with our European allies, were trying to help the Ukrainians negotiate a solution to the political crisis there. We supported a pacted transition between President Yanukovych, then president of Ukraine, and the opposition leaders on February 21st. And the next day, Yanukovych did not fulfill his obligations in terms of that agreement and instead fled the country. That's what triggered this crisis, not the West.
We've got Vice President Joe Biden, who is in Eastern Europe right now, trying to reassure NATO members there, former republics of the Soviet Union, many of them. And he's talking about what's just happened in Crimea as a result of a brazen military incursion, the vice president said, a blatant violation of international law. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin describes it as natural and inevitable. What is happening here, Ambassador McFaul? What's going to happen?
Well, I think what's happening is the end of what we used to call the post-Cold War order. If you go back to the years of Gorbachev, through the years of Yeltsin, President Yeltsin in Russia, and then the first term of President Putin, there was always a notion that Russia is integrating into the West and into international institutions and the global economy. And we had intermittent disagreements and serious ones, but there was always a sense that that was the direction of history. I think that's now over. I think that is over. I think President Putin has decided he wants to go his own way. He wants to play by his own terms, and he's no longer worried or going to react to criticism from the West as he begins to play a very different kind of game.
So how does this resolve? I mean, there's the vice president and the president of the United States saying this isn't legal. EU naming a couple of dozen folks to be sanctioned, the U.S. another dozen. How does this play through?
I don't know how it plays through, but I think it plays for a long, long time. This is different than the previous 30 years, right? We have not had annexation in Europe for 50 years. And I think it means there will be more confrontation between Russia and the West, zero-sum outcomes. And in particular, the immediate effect, we have to still worry about what happens in eastern Ukraine. President Putin said he has no intentions of going into eastern Ukraine today, and that's good that he said that. But I'll remind everybody listening today, a month ago, he never had any intention of going into Crimea. In fact, he's never given a single speech ever until really today about this longstanding concern he's had for the Russians in Crimea. So I think it's still a very volatile situation, and especially if there's violence in eastern Ukraine, there could be an action-reaction cycle that could spin out of control.
You say it's a confrontation that's going to go on a long time. Are we in a new Cold War, whether people like it or not?
It has attributes of the Cold War, yes. There are many differences, but it looks more like the Cold War than the post-Cold War order.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Russia, the West, and sanctions as Moscow moves to annex Crimea and Ukraine, and more wonder what comes next. Michael McFaul, Ambassador Michael McFaul, is with us. Until last month, he was U.S. Ambassador to Russia. He joins us today from Stanford, California. The President of the United States at the White House yesterday talking about the referendum in Crimea and saying don't go further, don't do more, announcing a series of sanctions against Russia. Here's President Obama.
Today I'm announcing a series of measures that will continue to increase the costs on Russia and on those responsible for what is happening in Ukraine. First, as authorized by the executive order I signed 2 weeks ago, we are imposing sanctions on specific individuals responsible for undermining the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and government of Ukraine. We're making it clear that there are consequences for their actions.
And here's Vice President Biden in Poland today, more blunt.
Russia has offered a variety of arguments to justify what is nothing more than a land grab, including what was said today. But the world has seen through Russia's action and has rejected the logic, the flawed logic behind those actions.
Vice President Joe Biden in Poland. There's a lot of nervousness now along the edge of Russia about what may come. Ambassador McFaul, what about the sanctions that the United States has outlined, the EU has laid out? Are they serious? They're being described as not that big a deal. How do you see them?
Well, yesterday's sanctions were very limited. Both the lists of the EU and the United States were limited. Today's actions in Moscow about annexation, I think, will trigger new sanctions against more individuals in Russia. And then the question is, how far will they go? My own view is that they need to go far, that they need to show, the president has said, Russia needs to pay a price. And let's be clear, not all Russians, not the country of Russia, but those responsible for this action. And so I do think the next step will be more names, and I hope they go as far as possible.
Is the West prepared to do that in united fashion? I mean, already 100-plus billion shifted out of U.S. Treasury custodial accounts by foreign central banks, other institutions, people three times more than last week, people saying that's Russian money. London, billions and billions of Russian in Russian dollars and money have gone through London. Is the West prepared to take a tough economic stance against Russia?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think there's a debate in all of the capitals in Europe and in Washington about how far to go. I do think the money moving out of Russia is striking. People are nervous despite all the nationalistic fervor that you heard in the halls there in the Kremlin today. There are a lot of Russian individuals that are seeking to move their money out of Russia. They're not moving their money into Russia. Just yesterday, for instance, one of the richest men in Russia, Mikhail Friedman, bought a major German energy company by over $5 billion. That's called capital flight. That's $5 billion that won't be invested in Russia. And I think over time, that's going to happen more and more often. And that will then, over time, over years, not days and weeks, that's not how sanctions work. But over time, there will be a debate about, is it worth it for us, we the Russians, to be isolated from the West and to be isolated from the international community? It's not just the West. The vote over the weekend at the UN Security Council was 13 against Russia's actions, one abstention from China, and the Russian veto. So this really is Russia against the entire international community.
And you're talking about the impact of that over time, Ambassador McFaul, but things have happened very quickly in Ukraine and Crimea. I wonder if things are just on two different cycles here. They're talking about sanctions that would bite over time, but Crimea may very, very soon be formally annexed. People are looking at eastern Ukraine and saying that could be next. I mean, is there a point at which this becomes a hotter confrontation? After all, this is right at NATO's doorstep.
Yes, I'm worried about it. I mean, with respect to Crimea, tragically, I don't see a way to reverse what has just happened today anytime soon. And we need to remain vigilant, as the president said, as the vice president said, as we were, by the way, when the Soviet Union annexed Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. But to think that that will be reversed anytime soon, I'm not optimistic. But I am worried about eastern Ukraine. I am worried about violence there that then triggers, action, reaction, and some kind of Russian response inside eastern Ukraine. That is the next place that we should be watching very closely.
Here's Senator John McCain on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday, Ambassador McFaul. He was, of course, just in Ukraine, in Kiev, saying here that the U.S. needs to be tougher with President Putin.
The United States of America, first of all, has to have a fundamental reassessment of our relationship with Vladimir Putin. No more reset buttons, no more tell Vladimir I'll be more flexible. Treat him for what he is. That does not mean reignition of the Cold War, but it does mean treating him in the way that we understand an individual who believes in restoring the old Russian empire.
John McCain, Senator John McCain there on Sunday. Ambassador McFaul, there is an almost explicit, certainly implicit criticism there of American policy in the time that you were U.S. ambassador in Moscow, that you were in Washington advising President Obama on Russia. Did we misread Vladimir Putin and Russia? Did we somehow set the table for the moves that we're seeing right now?
No. First of all, with respect to the reset ended a long time ago. Remember, President Obama canceled a summit planned with President Putin last summer, long before this current crisis. Since Vladimir Putin has become president, a cooperation between the United States and Russia has continued on issues of vital national interest, such as Iran, supplying our troops in Afghanistan, and with respect to the chemical weapons removal and destruction in Syria. But there's been no new initiatives. There's been no cooperation across the board. It's been the opposite. So that debate has ended long ago, in my opinion. The question of whether Obama could have prevented this annexation, I would just remind your listeners that, George W. Bush did not prevent Russia from invading Georgia in 2008. Ronald Reagan did not prevent the introduction of martial law in Poland, supported by Leonid Brezhnev, in 1981. And if we go way back, General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, did not stop Soviet tanks rolling into Hungary in 1956, which is just to say that it's not Democrat or Republican, weak or strong. It's just that the Kremlin, when they have decided to use force in Eastern Europe, has calculated, rightly, in my historic view, that the United States is not willing to use military force to counter that aggression. That's a pattern that goes way back.
Cast your eye more widely here. You talk about this as potentially a reconstitution of some kind of new Cold War. It's a horrible thought to people who felt such relief when the old one ended. George Bush, the senior, President George H.W. Bush, described a new world order after that. I don't know if it ever fully came to birth, but if it did, is it over now?
You know, in my opinion, and I know this will sound rather radical, I don't think it did. And we didn't actually win the first Cold War because democracy did not consolidate fully in Russia. Markets only regulate part of the economy inside Russia. And we did not, and the Russians did not, we both failed to fully integrate Russia into the international system. And so what you have now, it would be wrong to call it a return to the Cold War, call it Cold War Light or Cold War 2.0. But there are elements of it that are here today. Number one, you have an ideological struggle between democracy and autocracy. That is real, and we need to recognize it in that way. Number two, you have Russia's willingness to use force and other means to undermine sovereign states. That was a part of the beginning of the Cold War. It's back again today. And number three, therefore, Europe is divided between East and West, and countries, including now Ukraine, are divided between East and West. And I think we need to bear in mind that this is not just a temporary crisis in Crimea and that we can all get beyond it and get back to our business. I think this signals that Putin himself has decided this is the world that he's living in, and this is what he has chosen to force upon us. The question is, will we recognize it for what it is? And I think moving forward, that will be the test for European and American leaders.
Do you see other autocrats watching Vladimir Putin in Russia and Crimea, Ukraine, potentially on the move, on the march? China, North Korea, China looking at Taiwan, North Korea looking at who knows where. Will they be, if we've now got this kind of ideological conflict, does it look like a moment of opportunity to them?
Well, yes and no. On the one hand, the test of whether the free world, if you will confront this kind of aggression is important for stopping aggression around the world moving forward, without question. Everybody's watching that. But secondly, a lot of autocrats are also nervous about Russian aggression, because this sets some dangerous precedents for other countries as well. Remember, there are still millions of Russians living outside of the borders of the Russian Federation. And this now makes those countries, those leaders in those countries that have ethnic minorities, Russian minorities, I think very nervous about what happens over time. This is the beginning of a revisionist period in history in Europe. And I think that makes people very nervous.
Ambassador Michael McFaul, U.S. Ambassador to Russia until just last month, joining us today from Stanford, California. He's now at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. Ambassador McFaul, I'm sure we'll speak again. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Here's Russian President Vladimir Putin in his Kremlin speech today saying no plans to move into any other regions of Ukraine after Crimea and Sevastopol.
Don't believe those who say that Russia will take other regions after Crimea. We don't need that. Crimea has always been and will always be both Russian, Ukrainian, and Crimean Tatar.
Don't worry, saying Vladimir Putin today in Moscow. Let me bring in two other voices here. With us now from Washington, Eugene Rumer, director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, former National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the U.S. National Intelligence Council. Eugene Rumer, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
And from Oxford in England, Gwendolyn Zassa. She's professor of politics and international relations at Oxford University, expert on Ukraine and Crimea, author of The Crimea Question. Gwendolyn Zassa in Oxford, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hello. Hi, Tom.
I don't know how much of Ambassador McFaul's description of what's emerging here you just heard, but he's saying we are in a kind of Cold War light or Cold War 2.0, democracy versus autocracy. Is that a view you expect that Europe will adopt of what's going on here, Gwendolyn Zassa?
I think amidst the rhetoric, very strong rhetoric from both Russia and also the US and presumably also the EU later on today, we should not lose sight of what's really key now, which is the stability inside Ukraine. And it is, I think, meaningful and important that Putin stressed today that he does not intend to take further action in the east and south of Ukraine. And he addressed himself to the people of Ukraine, trying to reassure the people of Ukraine. So I think we should not, and the West should not now miss an opportunity to negotiate where you can still negotiate. So more long-term relationship, the more long-term relationship between the West and Russia looks problematic now. But there are real issues to be dealt with in Ukraine, and there are both from the Ukrainian government side. Just before the speech, Prime Minister Yatsenyuk indicated a few issues that he's willing to talk about, namely more powers for the Ukrainian, for the regions in the east of Ukraine, and also neutrality for Ukraine. And those are also issues that in recent days we've heard from the Russian Foreign Ministry. So I think this is the issues that really need to be addressed now, and that will be important for stability inside Ukraine and beyond.
Eugene Rumer, we had John Kerry, U.S. Secretary of State, himself talking about a federal structure for Ukraine that many are saying would give Russia much more sway over Ukraine. Maybe Vladimir Putin wanting neutrality there. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, it looked like the West was moving into the Ukraine. Now, does it look like the West is, in some sense, ceding Ukraine back to a Russian sphere of influence, or will, Eugene?
Well, I think in this situation, we're trying to get to some point where the very rapid escalation of tensions can be stopped and some mutually convenient arrangement can be negotiated. Clearly, this idea of federalization has been floating around for some time. It appears to be part of a Moscow strategy for dealing with sort of the next stage of bringing Ukraine back into Russia's orbit. I think a very big question is whether or not the people in the Maidan, who, to the best of my knowledge, have not disbanded yet, are prepared to accept this idea of federalization and neutrality for Ukraine. Don't forget that those are some of the most ardent supporters of the revolution and some of the most concerned Ukrainian citizens, concerned about Russian influence, and their voices for sure will be heard. So on the one hand, it is a step forward for Prime Minister Yatsenyuk to make that offer, although granted, it's really a setback for the Ukrainian government.
They're calling up a National Guard in Ukraine now. Can you see Ukraine and Russia going to war over eastern Ukraine? Can you picture it?
I cannot picture it. Honestly, it's something that is really unimaginable. If there is a force on force conflict between Ukraine and Russia, it is likely to be an incredible tragedy. And really, the Russian military is much stronger. Having said that, if there is really popular resistance, even in eastern Ukraine, if there are Ukrainian volunteers flowing in eastern Ukraine, this could be really the nightmare scenario that we all hope we can avoid.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Russia, the West, and sanctions. Vladimir Putin today speaking at the Kremlin, talking about Crimea. Coming back, annexation treaty signed, details to be worked out, but all this is now underway in the wake of the referendum in Crimea over the weekend as Russian troops were all over that Black Sea peninsula. Lots of Russians, ethnic Russians in Crimea, soon to be Russians again, fully celebrated the vote and the prospect of returning to Russia over the weekend. Here's one woman telling CNN how emotional the vote was for her, translated by CNN.
I have tears in my eyes. I want to cry. This is such an emotional day. I voted for Russia. We're finally going home.
And another man in Crimea, a voter on Sunday, talking with CNN.
This is a celebration because Russia is spiritually very close to us. It's the motherland, and it's where we always belonged.
President Obama seeing things differently. Not good what's happened already, and it can't go further, he said. In a statement yesterday at the White House, he's talking about escalating sanctions depending on what Russia does now. Here's President Obama.
Going forward, we can calibrate our response based on whether Russia chooses to escalate or to de-escalate the situation. Now, I believe there's still a path to resolve this situation diplomatically in a way that addresses the interests of both Russia and Ukraine. That includes Russia pulling its forces in Crimea back to their bases, supporting the deployment of additional international monitors in Ukraine, and engaging in dialogue with the Ukrainian government.
Vladimir Putin saying, don't worry, we're going as far as we're going. But, of course, he was saying that about Crimea just within the last couple of weeks. Eugene Rumer joins us today from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. Gwendolyn Zassa is with us, Ukraine and Crimea expert at Oxford University. And I want to come to you on what the president and EU are threatening here. But let me get a couple of calls, if I may. First, Mike in Berea, Kentucky. Mike, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I'm a former Marine. And I've also served with the UN in Kosovo, the Balkans. And I, of all people, do not want to see us enter into another frivolous conflict. I do not want to see us engage and put our noses in places that they don't deserve to be. However, this is an act of pure aggression. And we have to reframe our argument here and realize that we are dealing with a former KGB operative who has probably been involved in assassinations and illegal activity throughout the Kremlin in his time there.
You're talking about Vladimir Putin. Someone. Okay.
I'm talking about the president of Russia. He is not the same man that we would take him to be front face value. This is a KGB operative, and I think we've forgotten that.
So, Mike, but stick with me, Mike. You're making two observations there. One, you say, let's not get our nose in it. The business is not ours. The two, it's pure aggression. We have to do something. So what's it going to be?
I think we have to have the will. Our administration has to have the will to bring the West together. And I would remind everyone that if we're talking about really putting sanctions together here, they can shut the gas off to the EU. And the EU is an organization that was thinking about breaking off its currency just a little while ago. This isn't the most stable situation. And I just don't see us having the political will to do it. I'm simply stating that we have to see this for what it is and see the man behind the curtain for what he is. And figure out a long-term strategy, because like the ambassador said, this is the Cold War 2.0.
Gosh, I hate to hear that terminology, but maybe, Mike, we hear that, and we hear the ambivalence kind of baked into your whole view. I appreciate your call. One more, Bill in Northboro, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on.
You started off this whole discussion by asking if the Crimea was worth a new Cold War. Fine, Ukraine is not. Pardon me, the Crimea is not, but the Ukraine is. This is a test of Western democracy. And if Western democracy does not stand up for the Ukraine, then Western democracy has failed dismally. You have a situation here where the United States and Great Britain gave their solemn word. And if we don't stand up for our word, what is it going to count for in future situations here? And by the way, that same thing goes for Taiwan. This is a case where, number one, the Ukraine has a right to make their own decisions. Russia has absolutely no say in Ukraine's future. If the Ukraine wants to join NATO, and if they qualify for NATO, and if they fulfill all the demands that a democracy is supposed to have, namely no corruption, namely of operating judiciary and all the other things that we expect a NATO member to have, they have a right to join NATO.
Bill, we've got it. I'm going to jump in right there. You say Russia has no say. It looks to me right now like it does have a say. I mean, just boots are on the ground in Crimea, which was Ukraine until 5 minutes ago. Eugene Rumer, is there a line here? Where is it? And does the West have the tools and the will to mean it?
Well, this is really the critical question. I don't think anybody really knows, other than to say that probably in the near term we don't have very, very many tools. I think we can make political declarations and maybe move some forces to the frontline states bordering on Russia and Ukraine to indicate that we support our NATO allies. But we need to think about a long-term strategy for dealing with Russia, as one your caller very rightly pointed out, because the whole post-Cold War order is up for grabs now. We can no longer count on Russia as a partner, as we did until recently. Yet we have many equities where Russia will continue to play a very important role. We can't just say, Russia, stop selling your gas to the West, to Europe. Russia supplies about 30% of Europe's gas.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's not something that can be done overnight. Over a period of 5-10 years, perhaps, Europe can wean itself of this dependency on Russian gas. And at that point, it's not that Europe needs to stop buying Russian gas. It will diversify further its supply, and that could have considerable effect on Russia's ability to dictate its terms to Europe. But that's already happening anyway because of the changes in the gas market. We need to think about how to deal with Russia, for example, in the context of Iran, where Russia is a party to the conversation, a very important conversation. I don't believe for a minute that the Russians will exclude themselves from that conversation. All of these questions are really before us right now.
The fingers of this, the tendrils sprawl all over the place. Gwendolyn Zassa, do you see Vladimir Putin now, by other means, resuming his project of creating this Eurasian Union, a kind of reconstituted USSR? Has he found a new model in what we've just seen in Crimea? Trouble? Russian troops without insignia maybe show up? You've got a referendum. The next thing you know, it's a next. Do you think he'll try and replicate this elsewhere on Russia's perimeter?
I think he stressed, and there is grounds to believe him, that Crimea occupies a special place in Russia's thinking, in Russian post-Soviet mentality. The conditions are difficult to replicate in some of the places we might have in mind. So he has an interest in keeping the status of a number of territories in the former Soviet Union ambiguous, in Georgia, for example, in Moldova. But there aren't the same conditions in place and the same history in place as there was in Crimea. So for the moment, I don't think he has his eye on taking other parts of the post-Soviet space back, as it were. But of course, he's pursuing a number of different policies and integrating the space economically. You mentioned the Eurasian Union, the plan to push forward with a customs union. Those types of projects are ongoing, and Ukraine is an important factor in his calculations there. But Russia has over the years many times tried to make these types of unions work, and so far they haven't. So this is more of a medium-term, long-term project.
But we're hearing today that in the last week, the whole structure of the post-Cold War world has changed, maybe in the past handful of days. Maybe his calculations change along with that. Do you see a countervailing force, resistance, power, will in the West that would put a real price on Putin's further expansion? I mean, nobody wants to go to war. Is London going to really kick out all those billions in, lose access to all that money it's making off Russian finance now?
At the moment, there isn't the political will and the capacity in the West to do this. And so I think what we will see is that different policies will be pursued at different levels. So it will be a much messier game, but economic policies, possibly further economic sanctions that could in due course have some effect will be pursued. But at the same time, there will be different relations on different issues. So it will be much more issue specific. And that also opens up the space again to actually concentrate on Ukraine. And I wanted to go back to one point made before, that decentralization or federalization of Ukraine is a weakness. And I think actually Ukraine has, since independence, informally already acted like a sort of decentralized or federal state. And actually formalizing some of that arrangement might ironically strengthen the Ukrainian state and also protect it from further Russian pressure. So the fact that Russia is putting this idea of federalization on the table doesn't per se mean it's a bad idea. So it's actually ultimately in Ukraine's interest to strengthen the formal mechanisms around dealing with regional diversity, which it cannot easily get away from. And I also want to point to one actor that hasn't been mentioned at all in the discussion so far in Crimea. We also need to pay close attention to the Crimean Tatars there. And we don't know yet what will develop in the coming days and weeks. A group of about 250,000, 300,000 people in a region of about 2 million in total. They associate Moscow with their experience of deportation in the Soviet era. They have been quiet so far, but they are a mobilized, politically mobilized group. So we should not lose sight of that either. Putin today emphasized that he will respect their rights, that different languages will be the languages in Crimea, that we know that he's offered economic support to the Crimean Tatars, but their actual reaction to what is happening is unclear. So I think both that and the issue about how to strengthen the Ukrainian state as part of constitutional reforms, which will have to happen after the elections anyway, are really the key issues, in addition to more long-term calculations on the Western and Russian side.
Here was Catherine Ashton, the foreign affairs chief of the European Union, and this was before Vladimir Putin's speech, saying, don't do it, you don't have to do it, we don't want problems here, but Russia could still pull back. Here's Ashton.
We want to underline very clearly that there is still time to avoid a negative spiral and to reverse current developments, and we call on the Russian leadership not to take steps to annex Crimea and instead to take steps to de-escalate this crisis.
Within hours, Vladimir Putin making a very tough speech. It's all about moving ahead, seemingly unfazed by Western sanctions. Sasha in Neenah, Wisconsin. Sasha, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I just want to be brief. First of all, Ukraine got rid of its nukes in exchange for integrity as far as the territory goes and support from United States as well as European allies. And when you as United States and Europe goes to negotiate with other countries, it will be a very, very bitter pill for other countries to basically say, forget it, we're not doing it.
If we set a precedent here of ignoring that deal that Ukraine made, that treaty under which it gave up its nukes in return for guarantees.
Absolutely.
What about the sanctions, Sasha? Those are supposed to be the bite here. Sanctions already and more sanctions to come, Washington says.
The sanctions are all about money. If we would be serious about it, we would literally cut Russia off. And Russia knows that we will not, and therefore it will do whatever it wants to do. And Ukraine is just a first step. It will continue, just like people in Donetsk right now who are also Russian-speaking. It's coming. And when it comes to Polish borders, it will be too late.
When it comes to Polish borders, Sasha, thank you for your call. Let me get one more right here. Clarksville, Tennessee. Mark, you're on the air, Mark.
Hi, Tom. I got a question for the group here.
Yeah.
In terms of American foreign policy and the strategic national interest, we have a backdrop of, you know, the Syrian civil war, Iranian alleged nuclear weapons, the Afghan logistics train. America has more strategic interest in those issues that require Russian cooperation. So my question is, are we spending too much political capital on Crimean separatism, which really doesn't matter in the whole grand scheme of things in terms of American foreign policy? Are we pressuring Russia at the expense of those other issues?
Mark, let me ask you, how much would you give up for those other interests? The talks with Iran and Syria, troop access to Afghanistan, maybe Crimea is fine. What about Ukraine? What about Moldova? What about, I don't know, what if it goes to the Baltic states? How much would you surrender?
Well, That's a good point, but that's kind of a slippery slope argument, and that's too far to jump. Maybe we're getting involved, you know, so we can then draw back and say, look, we'll back down from this Ukrainian conflict if you chip in, if you actually meet your meet what you say you're going to do regarding Syria, regarding Iran. So it's a good question.
Mark, our time is short. Eugene Rumer, what about larger U.S. interests and what we see afoot here in Crimea and beyond? Ambassador McFaul saying we're in Cold War 2.0. What does that do to the U.S. and Russia on Iran, you know, Afghanistan, Syria? I mean, it's hardly been a big cooperative thing anyway, but maybe on chemical weapons.
Yes, I think it's really a very important fundamental issue in American foreign policy, and one that really presents our policy community with very difficult choices. On Iran, we'll continue to have a conversation with Iran, with Russia at the table. I think ultimately the key question is really about here. It's about Iran's intentions, not about Russia's role here. I think that that conversation really is not going to be terribly affected other than in terms of the atmospherics by what's happening in Ukraine. Syria, we have not seen much cooperation on Syria from Russia lately, as you said, except on chemical weapons. And I think the Russians have every interest in seeing that through, although, as I understand it, NATO has suspended some aspects of cooperation on that set of issues.
Boy, the sun coming up on a new day. I'm not sure exactly what it holds. Ambassador Michael McFaul, former, as of last month, U.S. Ambassador to Moscow, saying here it's Cold War 2.0, democracy versus autocracy. Let's hope not. But things are changing, and we've barely begun to take it on board. I'm grateful to the two of you for being with us today. Eugene Rumer at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Gwendolyn Zassa at Oxford University, Professor of Politics, International Relations there, author of The Crimea Question. Professor Zassa, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.